It is July the 22nd, a Wednesday, and this is Kathy coming to you with the News Gazette for today. At the top of the page, headline, Indictments Just the Start of Troubles Facing the Ammonses. When it rains, it pours. Right now, State Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat of Urbana, and her husband, Champaign County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Ammons, are getting drenched. Last week, they appeared in federal court in downtown Urbana for arraignment on criminal charges stemming from the alleged theft of campaign funds and state grant money. Awaiting a trial that could destroy their political careers and send them to prison, they have worries aplenty. Now the inevitable political repercussions are picking up steam. The Ammonses are under attack on three fronts, each constructed by Republicans and tolerated by Democrats. Locally, Scott Wilson, a Republican Champaign County Board member from Mahomet, has submitted a resolution to the board calling for the Aaron Ammons to resign. The county clerk administers our electoral process, said Wilson, who is challenging Democratic U.S. Rep. Nikki Buzinski in November general election. For election integrity, Clerk Ammons must resign immediately. At the same time, the Democratic-controlled House has scheduled an August 6th investigative committee hearing to begin looking into the alleged misconduct outlined in the recent federal indictment against the Ammonses. The committee is divided equally, three Democrats and three Republicans, with Democrat Chris Tarver II serving as chair and Republican Ryan Spain as the Republican leader. The other four committee members are Democrats Jay Hoffman and Lillian Jimenez and Republicans Adam M. Nieberg and Dan Agoste. Carol Ammons is charged with wire fraud and conspiracy to obstruct justice in connection with the theft of roughly $100,000 in campaign funds and grant money. Her husband is charged with obstruction of justice for allegedly encouraging witnesses to mislead investigators and conspiring with his wife to obstruct the probe. At the same time, daughter Tatiana Ammons also is charged in federal court with improperly receiving unemployment compensation while she was working. Tatiana Ammons, according to her parents' indictment, also improperly received a series of $600 monthly payments from Carol Ammons' campaign committee, the Friends of Carol Ammons. The final GOP thrust comes in the form of an online advertisement that features a picture of the couple, accompanied by a voiceover stating, "Are you a nonprofit looking for state money? Then call Carol Ammons today." The process is simple. Hire her daughter, receive taxpayer-funded grants, and send a little something back to the family. That's right. No complicated paperwork. No long approval process. Just one convenient family connection. Call 1-800-KICKBACK now and ask about the Ammons family funding plan. But hurry. This offer may end without notice, especially if the FBI calls first. The ad, scathing in its insinuations, represents the intersection of law and politics. Despite that, however, Carol Ammons is running for re-election without opposition. Aaron Ammons also is seeking re-election, but with opposition previously thought token in solidly Democrat Champaign County. It remains to be seen what effect the indictment will have on his re-election prospects. Both Ammonses have publicly stated they have been falsely accused and expect to be found not guilty at their forthcoming trials. County Board Chair Jennifer Locke said Wilson's resignation resolution will be on Thursday's board agenda, but it may not be voted on because it could be tabled for discussion and a vote later. A lawyer, Locke said she objects to calls for Ammons's resignation and that the resignation issue can be addressed after the trial. In my heart, I'm a defense attorney who subscribes to the innocent until proven guilty approach, she said. Locke characterized the resolution as strictly symbolic because the board has no power to force the resignation of an elected official. Wilson, too, characterized himself as a supporter of the innocent until proven guilty approach, but he said the public deserves the complete attention of its elected officials, not one distracted by an upcoming trial. The feds are serious, and it takes serious energy to fight an allegation, Wilson said. And this article is written by Jim Day, who is a staff writer for the News Gazette. This next headline, State Tries to Link Evidence to First of Two Suspects, by Luke Taylor. The trial for one of the two brothers arrested in connection with the 2025 homicide began Tuesday, with investigators starting by painting a picture of what was found at the South Urbana scene. Damani Trice, 18, was arrested in August alongside his brother, Decam Trice, 19, in the February 7, 2025 incident that led to the death of 18-year-old Sherman McCraney. Each was charged with four counts of first-degree murder. Police initially responded to the 2000 block of Water Street for reports of a shooting at 8:22 p.m. that day, but later determined that the incident itself occurred at 8:01 p.m. Officers who arrived on the scene found Mr. McCraney on the ground, face up, with a gunshot wounds to the upper right torso. Investigators also located a firearm nearby, but later determined that it had belonged to the victim. In court Tuesday, an Urbana police detective explained photos taken at the scene, with evidence markers identifying the locations of various findings, including groupings of bullet casings. There was also a water bottle lying in the street that had visible water in a puddle around it when the police arrived. Police found surveillance footage of the incident which showed shots being fired at Mr. McCraney, followed by two people running west on Mitcham Drive. Assistant State's Attorney Brooke Hinman presented location data from Damani Trice's cell phone that appears to place it in that area at the time of the incident. A witness told police that they heard gunfire and saw a tall, thin black male in all-black clothing running west on Mitcham, then south on Cottage Grove Avenue. The same witness said they also saw a shorter, stockier black male wearing all black stopping to catch his breath before walking west on Mitcham. A detective who testified Tuesday said that he spoke to both Trice brothers and that he could easily tell the difference between the two of them by build. He placed Damani as the slightly shorter and more heavy-set of the pair and Dakari as the taller and slimmer. A forensic scientist from the Illinois State Police Lab also testified, explaining how splint casings could be matched with the gun used to fire them as long as the lab is in possession of that firearm. A member of the Street Crimes Task Force discussed the execution of a search warrant on the Trice's home on August 26, 2025. Inside, investigators found multiple firearms, including one in each of the brothers' rooms. The task force member said one room was identified as Damani's, based on a school ID found inside. That room also had a part of a second firearm, two magazines, ammunition, and an invoice for five Polymer 80 firearms. Known as ghost guns, Polymer 80 firearms are shipped as 80% finished, allowing customers to finish putting them together after they arrive. The completed firearms do not have serial numbers. The Trice's residence, where that evidence was recovered, was less than a mile from the scene of the shooting. Despite Damani Trice being under age of 18 when he was arrested, he is being tried as an adult due to the severity of the alleged crime. The state is expected to continue presenting its case, and the trial resumes this morning. This headline is called The Literary, a Book Nook. Newly acquired house will allow downtown bookstore bar to expand with events and retreats by Jana Wersma. To Jenny Shima, starting a new business always requires taking a leap of faith. That was certainly true when she chose to open a combination bookstore and bar downtown mid-pandemic in 2021. "We've been very lucky at the Literary with the community we've been able to be a part of," she said of her business, which now includes food and coffee service as well. "And we just want to do more, create more for our community and new ways to gather, to engage in our reading." With that in mind, Shima has taken another leap of faith, buying a historic home on Springfield Avenue to convert into a space for weekend reading retreats and other events. She hopes to have the first booking available for a fall date. "And again, we find ourselves in a shaky economy, so I have really excellent instincts for when to start businesses," she joked. Shima acknowledged the chancy nature of her purchase in a Facebook video that begins with her sliding across the floor, using a candlestick holder as a mic, and looking into the camera in an homage to risky business. In discussing the origins of the project, she told the News Gazette that, since she was about 12, she had a secret deep fantasy of owning an inn one day. "Things are changing really fast in our world," she added, "and the ability to slow down and connect is precious, and it's really hard to find. So kind of when I came across this house, sort of those ideas came together. And I thought if we were able to create retreats where people were able to slow down and connect around reading, it would bring a lot of joy to people and help us strengthen our community even more." The four-bedroom, two-bath home was built in 1898 and is just a short drive away from the Literary. Shima bought the house in late June for $495,000 through an LLC, according to county tax records. Shima said that the home is beautiful and has benefited from thoughtful renovations completed by previous owners. "I love how faithful they were to the original look of the house," she said. "It has so much character, so much trim, so much detail, and the original pocket doors. It's just fun." She added that the house has lots of space for gathering. Shima's vision for the home includes turning one of the first floor rooms into a library that guests can sleep in, complete with a pull-down bed behind a bookcase. Upstairs in the attic, there are three little nooks that I would love to turn into little reading huts, kind of like little reading nooks, little roofs with shingles, kind of hobbity, a little bit on the outside, something really fun and whimsical, she added. Shima's to-do list around the house also continues putting up wallpaper, painting, design work, and perhaps making some changes to the fireplace. We have a local woodworker building our library, Alan Paul Strong, she said. He's an incredibly talented local builder who does lots of fine detailed work. In discussing the readers' retreats she hopes to host, Shima said that the exact plans are still evolving, but the vision is getting your best friends together and gathering for a weekend. The getaway might begin on a Friday night, followed by a beautiful breakfast buffet Saturday morning, and other activities sprinkled throughout the day, such as book bedazzling, book clubs, or an update from the literary staff on upcoming book releases. Shima doesn't plan to have streaming services set up at the house, and is instead looking at providing a selection of DVDs, films based on books, if guests want to have an old-school movie night with a literary twist. The literary will cater bar service, mocktail service, food, whatever is desired, she said. Hopefully it culminates in breakfast at the literary on Sunday morning, so if it can be as involved with the literary during your experience as you like. She added that these ideas, the concept, the exact plan, yet. Not the exact plan. Bloomberg reported in April that reading retreats have sprung up across the U.S. and the U.K. in recent years, with getaways often selling out months in advance. On the lower end of the scale, prices can range from $950 to $1,750 per person for a weekend retreat hosted by Page Break, which sometimes take place at campgrounds, the outlet said. At the other end of the spectrum, the Ladies Who Lit offers luxury getaways in destinations such as Barcelona or the Greek islands, which can cost about $2,300 to $10,000 per person for a 4 to 8 day trip, the outlet said. Most readers' retreats are happening for thousands and thousands of dollars per person, Shima said. This one is going to be a fraction of that cost per person. We want this to be more accessible and more available to people. She also hopes to rent the home out for events such as baby showers, family reunions, private book clubs, small weddings, and whatever the community needs the space to be. We have a lot of people who want to do private events at the literary, and it's difficult for us to accommodate because we don't have a lot of space, she said. She also likes the idea of using the home to host book-themed parties, with activities such as live-action role-playing for Lord of the Rings fans or lemonade and badminton for Bridgerton devotees. Shima has yet to settle on a name for the house. She and the staff of the literary have thought about using the name of a fictional home, such as Barton Cottage from Sense and Sensibility. In her Facebook post announcing the project, Shima asked the community for name ideas. Some of the names Facebook users brought up include The Litreat, The Lit Lodge, The Retreat, Stay Lit, Literary Escape, and The Allegory. And there is a picture here of Jenny Shima, who is the owner of the literary, and she's standing outside the Champagne home she recently purchased. Top of the morning. Something to get you going today. Courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. On Wednesdays, we'll chop it up with our golfer of the week. Cole Maxey and his team could have double bogeyed every hole, and they still would have enjoyed Saturday's groundbreaking tournament at Railside Golf Club in Gibson City. We knew it was important just to be out there and help, Maxey said. First thing I told them is, when we're done, you should do this again in the fall. It was great. Friends of Railside's first annual golf event was so popular that organizers had to split teams into morning and afternoon sessions. Money raised at the inaugural 25-team scramble went toward maintenance of the volunteer-run 12-hole course that continues to defy odds. A 2020 graduate of Gibson City, Melvin Sibley, Maxey, and three high school classmates, Bryce Boundy, Jordan Blake, Tanner Cribbett, shot 10-under to win the men's division. They plan to return their winnings to the volunteers responsible for a pristine layout. It's in better shape than most courses around, Maxey said. Each team forked over $200 to play. Plus, 30-hole sponsors contributed to the cause, with Gibson City's Drummer Creek Catering supplying the food. Course owners Bernadette and Darren Ray described the day as humbling, adding that the volunteers are not friends, they are family. Maxie grew up playing railside with his dad, Nick, in its original 18-hole form. Now 24 and working for the Gibson Area Hospital, he remains a regular who is appreciative of the opportunity to golf in his hometown. "They're helping grow the sport," said Maxie, who coaches middle school wrestling in Gibson City and frequently sees students on the course. "It's special what they're doing." Farm Family of the Week. Meet the Reevstecks of Tolono. Scott Reevstek started his agriculture journey halfway through elementary school, helping his father. Now the farmer, who is approaching retirement, shares the same kind of relationship with his son, Alec. Question: how long has your family been farming? "I joined my father, Vern, on the farm full-time in 1976 when I rented my first land. Alec rented his first land in 2017. Dad started at this location in 1945 when he came home after the war. I've been working on the farm since I was old enough to start feeding the cattle, probably about third grade." "Where is your farm operation?" "We are located in the Tolono area." "And where did your family come from?" "Grandpa George Reevstek came over from Germany in the 1800s and settled north of Tolono. The farm is still in the Reevstek family." "What does your operation consist of? Is it strictly grain, livestock, or other?" "We are now primarily in grain operation, growing corn and seed soybeans." "How many people in the family does the operation support?" "The farm supports my wife, Mary, myself, and my son, Alec. My brothers and I share in some land ownership." "And how many generations are there?" "Alec is the fourth generation to be in farming." "Do any family members in the farming operations also work other jobs?" "My wife, Mary, has recently retired from nursing after being a registered nurse for over 40 years. My daughter, Bailey, lives in Nashville and works in business there. Alec has several part-time jobs off the farm." "Your farm equipment, green, John Deere, red, Case, IH, or other?" "We primarily run international equipment, but there's a smattering of other colors here also." "What soil conservation practices do you employ on the farm?" "We have been doing no-till beans since the early 80s and minimum tillage on corn. We are just starting to work with cover crops." "What's the best time of the year to be on the farm?" "I love the spring season for new beginnings, summer for watching the crop grow, and fall for the cool, crisp weather and harvest. As I grow older, winter is becoming a little less attractive on the farm." "How have you seen farming change over the years?" "The changes to farming have been massive over the years and seem to be accelerating, mainly driven by the adaptation of new technology. When I first started helping on the farm, we were using four-row equipment and a big tractor was less than 100 horsepower. Now I have 16-row equipment and over 300 horsepower tractors, and that isn't even big by today's standards. Through better plant breeding, crop yields have doubled since the early 70s. All this has changed the size and efficiency of farm operations dramatically. The effect of technology isn't just apparent in agriculture, but in everyone's life. Everything is bigger, faster, and easier. Is it better? I think so, but I believe we will miss the vibrant small towns, many local businesses, and personal services they provided. And what makes farming such a good vocation? Working with Mother Nature every day and the challenges that it presents on a daily basis is a part of what makes farming great. Then you get to work with great people and fellow farmers, which enhances your experiences. For me, though, I think that when I started farming, I got to have my father as a mentor, business partner, and daily companion. And now, as I approach retirement, I get to be on the other side and share some of those same experiences with my son, Alec. This is what makes farming one of the best vocations there is. And if you could change one thing about farming, what would it be? If I only get one thing, it would be to smooth out the volatility of the markets. Since that is not going to happen, I would want to be a better predictor of where the markets are going. No matter how hard I try to figure it out, the markets just seem to elude me. I can't think of another farmer who wouldn't want that. Advocates for Aging Care. Proposed Savoy Nursing Home receives state permit. Next step, buying land near South Madison West Church. A project intended to help alleviate Champaign County's shortage of long-term care beds has received the go-ahead from state regulators. Advocates for Aging Care and developer FAPROP LLC's permit application for a new skilled nursing facility in Savoy received unanimous approval from the Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board on Tuesday, said Kathy Emanuel, committee chair for Advocates for Aging Care. "We're very excited about the outcome," she said. "This is the first step toward really making this a reality, so a really critical step for us. I'd like to thank State Senator Paul Faraci, who came and spoke on our behalf in front of the board, and his support made a great deal of difference for them. We had great encouragement from the board members who said this was a fascinating project and they look forward to us moving ahead with it. Next steps will include moving forward with buying land for the project, which could potentially break ground this fall and open by spring 2028, she said. In addition to Faraci, Emanuel also thanked advocates for Aging Care's partners at OSF Healthcare, the University of Illinois, Carle Health, and Parkland College. The $26.6 million project includes 120 beds and will be located on 10 acres near the northeast corner of West Church Street and South Mattis Avenue. The project concept features 10 home-like cottages in a campus residential setting per the application to the state. Each cottage will include 12 units, with each unit having its own private room and bathroom, and common spaces such as a group dining area, a living area, and outdoor space. Two of the cottages will be located near each other, with a rehabilitation area in between, providing therapy to residents who require rehabilitation services. Advocates for Aging Care plans to be the nonprofit operator for the facility and contract Southern Administrative Services, which is a related entity to FAPROP, to manage it. Plans also include working with Aging Inn to implement the greenhouse model. In addition to the cottage housing style, the approach involves employing certified nursing assistants as universal workers who provide personalized care to residents and handle in a variety of tasks, the project application stated. A report by the Reviews Board staff issued earlier this month found that Advocates for Aging Care and FAPROP's application met most of the state's criteria, except for a requirement that the applicants show proof of funding to cover initial startup costs. Emanuel said at that time that the facility needs $2.5 million in working capital and has about $750,000 in commitments as it works to raise these funds. Ford County Court, retired PBL teacher sentenced to sex offender probation, by Will Brumlevy, Pontiac. As expected, retired Paxton Buckley Lota High School teacher Paul Muser was sentenced to 30 months of sex offender probation Monday following his guilty plea in May to felony charges of grooming and indecent solicitation of a child. Judge Mary Cole imposed the sentence on Muser 72 of Buckley, as recommended in a negotiated plea agreement, Ford County State's Attorney Andrew Killian said. Moiser's teenage victim was consulted about the proposed sentence and agreed to the sentences set forth. In accepting the sentence as recommended by both Killian and Moiser's attorney, Lance Cagle, Cole called the sentence reasonable and appropriate, especially since the findings of a sex offender risk assessment, in addition to the victim herself, supported a community-based sentence. In addition to being placed on sex offender probation through January 20, 2029, Moiser was ordered to pay court fines and fees totaling $4,314. Moiser must also register as a sex offender for at least 10 years. For the terms of the probation order, Moiser is prohibited from communicating or living with any child, attending any events where children are expected to be present, being at or around schoolyards, parks, playgrounds, arcades, or any other places primarily used by children, possessing any sexual materials or patronizing any place where such materials are available, and making any contact with the victim or living within 500 feet of the victim or her immediate family. Moiser must also allow probation officers to forensically examine his computer, phone, and electronic devices and access his social media accounts to look for any evidence of sexual material or attempted contacts with children. Moiser is also subject to home visits by probation officers and random drug and alcohol testing. Before Cole imposed the sentence, Cagle noted the findings of Moiser's sex offender risk evaluation along with his lack of criminal history, while Killian read a statement on behalf of Moiser's victim. According to charging documents filed in court, Moiser, a former teacher's education and physical education teacher at PBL High School, invited the female teenager to his home last Christmas Eve, intending to commit a sexual act with her. Also, over the course of nearly a year, between January 2025 and December 24, 2025, Moiser allegedly offered the teen snacks and money, discussed things of a sexual nature, including his desire to perform acts of sexual penetration with the child, and exchanged emails with her outside of school. Before this situation occurred, I already struggled with the understanding healthy boundaries because of the treatment I experienced from adults throughout my life, the victim said in her statement to the court. As some of you know, my background consisted of being exploited by many adults who were meant to protect me. This deeply affected the way I viewed love, attention, and safety. I want everyone to know that when I entered this situation, I was a vulnerable child, looking for care and guidance from an adult I thought I could trust. I was desperate to be seen and listened to. When Paul gave me that safe space I was never given, I felt like I could share the most vulnerable and painful parts of my life with him. And when I did, those conversations slowly stopped feeling like healthy support from a trusted adult and started becoming emotionally blurred. The more vulnerable I became with him, the more he positioned himself as the person who understood me better than everyone else. Because of the treatment I grew up with, I mistook that emotional intensity for safety and care. And that is why I am not a perfect victim, because once I started to recognize the sexual aspects of his behavior, part of me became emotionally invested too. It made me uncomfortable, but at the same time it also felt validated to be wanting and needed by someone I trusted. That is difficult for me to admit, but I believe it's important because people expect victims to either be completely unaware or completely unwilling the entire time. But grooming does not always work that way. Just because my story looks different than others doesn't mean I'm not a victim. I was not capable of consenting to or to fully understand the dynamic of mine and Paul's relationship. I was a child trying to understand relationships through the lens of trauma. He is an adult who fully understood the position of power and influence he had over me. A big part of who I am now has been shaped not only by what happened to me, but by learning who I no longer want to be because of it. And I've grown and matured. I've started to understand this situation in ways I could not fully understand at the time it was happening. I can now recognize the manipulation, and I can confidently say that what happened was not okay. Not because someone told me it wasn't, but because I truthfully understand what I deserved. This journey has been painful, but it has also been an important part of rebuilding myself and continuing to stay strong. Moise was placed on administrative leave from his job at PBL High in March, only to resign days later. Moise, a 2024 PBL Alumni Hall of Fame inductee, a 1972 Paxton High School graduate, said, was a Hall of Fame head boys basketball coach and teacher in Oklahoma before he returned to Paxton a few years ago. Moise, who was arrested and charged shortly after his resignation, pled guilty to the May 6th to charges of grooming, a Class 4 felony, and indecent solicitation of a child, a Class 3 felony. In exchange, Killian agreed to dismiss two Class 2 felony counts of attempted criminal sexual assault. Kaylee Hottle. Deaf Godzilla actor 18 killed as a passenger in a car accident, by Rebecca Boone and Larry Legg. Kaylee Hottle, a deaf actor best known for her starring role in two Godzilla films, died in a car crash early Tuesday morning in Maryland. The Frederick County Sheriff's Office said she was 18. Hottle was one of two passengers in the car when it went off the road and hit a culvert before 3 a.m. in iGemsville. The driver was taken to a local hospital with non-life-threatening injuries, and the other passenger declined medical treatment, according to a news release from the sheriff's office. Excessive speed is believed to be a factor in the crash, which is under investigation, the sheriff's office said. Hottle was a native signer of American Sign Language, and her family members are also deaf. Her parents, Joshua and Ketsey Hottle, shared emotional video statements about her death on social media sites. Kaylee's mom and four siblings are crushed, her father said in ASL on a post from the airport. They are together at home grieving. I am on my way to Maryland to bring Kaylee's body back home. Hottle's heart stopped before she arrived at the hospital, transported by air from the scene of the accident, her father said. I am very grateful for the 18 years we had together and wish we had more, he said. Joshua Hottle also reached out to the driver described by the sheriff's office as a 19-year-old Frederick man. I have forgiven you, her father said. Don't let this incident ruin the rest of your life. I still feel that Kaylee is with us, her mother said in ASL in a post. That's all we have time for in this first half of the News Gazette. I will be back in a couple of minutes and bring you the second half.